the views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the management and staff of Guardian Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Guardian Radio AM. Today is Tuesday, July 7th. It's a little after 11 o'clock in the morning. Once again, to C.A. Nuri, and I shall be your host for the day. We continue in our series about American independence and Bahamian independence and how both countries intertwine and how we have had a symbiotic relationship from inception, from the discovery of the Bahamas. Let's say rediscovery. Look at I used that word. The first encounter of the old world to what they call the new world. And we've been, even safe to say, twin brothers, one bigger than one, I guess, and so on. So, but we are interrogating, rehashing our history, explaining how we in the Bahamas have impacted the United States and, of course, how the United States has impacted the Bahamas. Of course, it's a hot summer. I mean, it's so hot that you need to have a vacation break. And of course, in order to facilitate that vacation break, the Great Summer Escape Giveaway, the Guardian Radio and Guardian Media Group is having the Great Summer Escape Giveaway. You could win a trip for two, including the hotel, including the car, including your luggage, and $1,000 in cash. All you need is your passport. I guess they ain't talking to me. But all you need is your passport. I'm still working on my passport, by the way. That's why I said I can't even participate in that. Anyway, all you need is your passport. Just get a Nassau Guardian newspaper. Fill out the entry form. Drop it in the entry box at the Nassau Guardian in Oaks Field. That means you come up to the front desk and just drop it inside. And tune in to Guardian Radio and follow the Nassau Guardian on all social media platforms. That's Facebook and Twitter. For your chances to win. The Guardian Media Group, Great Summer Escape Giveaway. Deadline to enter is actually August 12th. You have some time to participate, but it's August 12th is the deadline, and the drawing is 2 days afterwards, which is going to be on August 14th. If you buy the newspaper, you might as well fill it out, right? You just might as well fill it out and get your chance to travel. Again, we have historian Christopher Davis in studio. We're going over the date. We now are in the 1800s. We are about to start the American Civil War. We're about to start the impact it had on the Bahamas, how the Bahamas look, American Civil War. We're going it now to the 20th century, 1900s. So that's where we're going to start off this day's discussion. So now, Chris.
Yeah.
Explain to me what was happening during the American Civil War and then how that impacted the Bahamas.
So in the lead up to the Civil War, of course, as you saw in the Bahamas, you know, slavery was always a big thing. And of course, slavery was essentially what the Civil War was based on. Some people...
But we're free here in the Bahamas.
Well, in the United States, they weren't free. And of course, the last thing we spoke about too, this concept of the saltwater on Underground Railroad raged on and manifested itself in many different ways. So I'd be remiss not to mention a case that they actually called the Creole case. Creole actually not being the people themselves, or even though technically they were, because Creole essentially meant in the British world, any African that was born in the Western Hemisphere, right? But the Creole in this case was the name of a ship which had a revolt, which is considered one of the most successful uprisings by enslaved people in the history of the United States. And long story short, it was a ship that left from Virginia and that was supposed to be taking all of these quote-unquote troublesome people down to New Orleans. And when they got about 100 miles east of Abaco, this is when they did this revolt. And they purposefully came to the island of New Providence, well, more specifically the port of Nassau, right there where the cruise ships pull up, knowing that there had been other cases where African-Americans were freed from American ships. So this is another entire arm of this grand thing that we call the Saltwater Underground Railroad.
So let me rehash that or ask you this question directly. Mm-hmm. in United States history.
Yeah.
They name one slave revolt as their only successful revolt happened in the United States.
Yeah.
Where did that happen?
So that one would be, I wouldn't even call it the most successful, but it's certainly the most infamous. And that would be the Nocturnal Revolt that happened in Virginia.
Wasn't successful. They owned that.
Right.
In the Bahamas. That ship that they turned back and would hide that.
Oh, so that's it there. Okay, I thought you was talking about, right, yeah,
no.
Of course, right.
No, you got to rehash that, make sure.
Right, so it is the most successful because, as I was going to say, even after the Nocturnal Rebellion, far more African Americans were lynched in response to the 95 people or so that were killed by Nocturnal and his rebels, right? The Creole case was led by Madison Washington and another man, more importantly in the context of what we're talking about, named Elijah Morris. And essentially, this ended with the freedom of 139 or so African Americans. 19 had to remain because they were the ones that did the revolt. And the rowdiest fellow on this revolt was a man named Elijah Morris. And Elijah Morris is the one that actually settled and became one of the largest landowners in what we now know as Gambia Village. So Gambia Village was very similar to Adelaide and Fox Hill in the sense that African people of African descent were settled there, and you see it far away from the main city of Nassau, so they kind of was a way for the British to kind of keep them sort of ostracized in that way. However, in Gambia, these were African Americans who were treated much differently than the so-called liberated Africans, who is really a misnomer because it was just a slick way for the British to continue to exploit African labor, right? So even after slavery ended, it's important to note that the British still on these ships that brought people directly from the continent, they would quote-unquote liberate them in the Bahamas, but really it was the same, basically for the most part, the same planter class that got these Africans. 11 of them were, for example, at Clifton, living and working among the enslaved, yet they call them liberated Africans, right? Now, that between the Bahamas, when, of course, remembering in this context, we're still a British colony in the U.S., there was a lot of beef going on. And this case was not fully adjudicated until the 1850s, right? And all of this actually added fuel to the fire of the civil rights movement, right? And it's important to note that in the Bahamas, throughout the British Caribbean, the colonies in the Caribbean, in the United States, in Brazil, in the lead up to emancipation, a key role in that was actually this consistent resistance that manifested in all sorts of ways. It manifested in the case that we spoke about, the Creole. It manifested with people like Mary Prince, who fought more so with the pen than with the sword, right? And it manifested in many ways. And this made slavery extremely expensive as well, you understand? And those that owned slaves and benefited from it, of course, wanted to keep it. And it was the lifeblood of Western economies at the time, even up until that time. And so this is what leads us up now to the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And this is where something that people complain about, some people praise it. It's a very complex reality of who we are as a people, you know? But you always hear people say, oh, well, you know, we've always been pirates, we've always been smugglers. And this, again, wears its face during the American Civil War, where we were known for blockading. And in that sense, that would have been kind of working on the Confederate side. Mm-hmm. But Bahamians just used that opportunity to play both sides of the fence, right? Well,
the Bahamians were more on the southern side, eh? We made more money.
Officially, they were more on the southern side, but they also worked for Northerners. It was pretty much anybody, anybody that would benefit, you know. So Bahamians were involved in smuggling things through that same blockade that we were supposed to be officially in, sort of, or unofficially, if you will, involved in doing, right? And of course, the American Civil War was all about state rights, right? But you know, this sort of goes in with that old sort of saying, that is wouldn't be so good from a diplomatic sense, but it's true for the most part from a historical sense, which is that when America does badly, the Bahamas prospers. Mm-hmm. Now, I think with tourism, of course, being a number one industry today and our own economy shifting drastically, I would argue that that's no longer the case.
Yeah.
We could remember 9/11.
Yeah.
We could remember the crash in 2008, thereabouts. Mm-hmm. We could remember, of course, COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And when the Americans ain't doing well, we suffer because they ain't coming here.
So let's talk about the Volstead Act, Pro 1920 to 1933.
So this was something that was rooted in so many things. And a lot of it was actually rooted in this sort of Christian dogma that was still rampant in the United States at the time. You know, and they were moving into other prohibition and other farther substances as well, right? So even things like opium that was taken as a medicine, people started to second guess it. So even the Volstead Act in itself, you know, did a lot of damage. But the whole entire, in my view, the whole entire sentiment was not coming from a bad place. They were starting to realize certain things. And I think alcohol just got in that. The problem with alcohol, though, was that it's something that was so widespread. I would make a parallel, actually, to gambling. You hear a lot of people talk about, the people vote no for gambling, and they still do this and that. But you have to understand when something is so widespread, you know, and gambling and alcohol, though, it can be harmful if done responsibly. It wouldn't be as much of a social ill. I think we could all agree on that. Most of us drink and many of us gamble, right? But when you're looking at things, the hard drugs like heroin and stuff like that, that's where I think you could say that the prohibition was not from a completely bad place, right? But in the context of alcohol, it was, of course, as we know, a disaster for the United States.
How did Bahamas benefit, though?
Right. Of course, it gave rise to gangsterism because you prohibit, and all it did was really create this explosion of a black market where all these nefarious characters like your Al Capones could rise. And, of course, Al Capone, right where, that street name, boy, why is never being remembered over? Right where Greycliff and them is, where they have the Heritage Museum and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
The building that would be the most wested one, I believe it is, within that complex, was actually the place he named it after his little sweetheart.
Who named it there?
Al Capone.
And so Al Capone was in the Bahamas?
He owned that building.
And Al Capone owned property in the Bahamas?
He owned property, and not just that. That's where he stored his gin and his whiskey.
Al Capone stored whiskey and rum in the Bahamas.
Oh, yeah, right downtown, you know? And this was quite different and something we could probably come up to probably near the end, which is the 1970s and 80s. And that was a more, let's call it, freer market. We're talking about the drug trade, mm-hmm. right? And furthermore, that was open to almost anybody that had the fortitude or the stupidity, depending on your perspective, to get into that.
Were black behemoth engaging in rum running?
Exactly. And this way I'm getting. You did have a few, and they would have mostly been the lighter hue. Right. But generally speaking, and you could see all the pictures, some of them might have risen to be the captain of a sloop. But these were generally almost 100% owned by white Bahamians. And this is one of the things that spurred huge development in the Bahamas as well. And what coincided with that era of prohibition was a economic boom and a sort of boost in tourism. Right. And this was long before Stafford Sands's heyday. This was actually as he was entering into politics. But this was something, tourism from Florida by people like Robert Cunard, the other one, and Henry Flagler, I believe the first name being Henry, you know. So these were people from the United States. They had a steamship coming from New York. One was even coming from London at the time. The one from New York and Miami was in existence before Stafford Sands even existed. He was just well-placed through the racism, through his shrewdness in politics and in his business to make all this money through tourism. But they had partnership with all these nefarious characters, you know. And around that period, you know, this is the years leading up before World War
just to one, World War II as well.
So all of this was sort of interconnected, right? And the Bahamas was a quite interesting place. Some would call it neutral ground. And I guess you could say that because, of course, at this time we had a relationship going with the Americans. But at this time, the Bahamas' relationship was not cozy with the United States. This was actually the only time people has always feared this blacklist from America. Well, the Bahamas has been blacklisted by America a few times, actually. And this was all happening during that period of prohibition leading up into, I believe, it even happened one time during World War II. And this would have been because of people like the Duke of Windsor, right? And nefariousness to Nazis. There's a great story done by Nicole Roberts. Shout out to her and Bohemianology, where she talks, highlights some stories of Bohemians, people in the Bahamas, who were actually being arrested for being Nazi sympathizers, right? And people don't understand that the Bahamas is a place where the British would send their undesirables, particularly those that seemed to have fascist or Nazi leanings.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the real reason that the so-called Duke of Windsor
in fact, they said,
was sent over and had to abdicate the throne.
I saw an article was suggested that Nazis sponsored Burma Road Riot. I just saw the article in the newspaper. Yeah, it was a newspaper article.
I find it incredibly hard to believe, because the riot in itself, if you had to pick one person who was against, it would have been the governor, right? And the premier, it would have been against them too. They were the people who were in charge. And he was very neglectful. He spent a lot of time in New York, but I don't want to stray away too much. And then, of course, we had a U.S. base here and a British base here during World War II. Right, so one was in where we call Oaksfield right now, and that was the British one. And the U.S. one, I believe, was around where Burma Road, Blake Road area, if my memory serves. Or was it? Yeah, around there. And I think it was even another one out by where the other one? Somewhere, it was another one somewhere. I think it might have been on another island. But during that time, a lot of Bahamians were employed in building these military bases as well. And of course, you know, the United States and Britain at this point were no longer enemies as they were less than 100 years before that.
Let's talk about the great migration up north. Bahamians now moving to the United States from the southern part of the Bahamas going north.
So this began since the mid-1800s, right? And at that time, there was a lot of blacks, but a lot of it was centered around whites, particularly when you look at areas like Coconut Grove. But there was also huge black migration. And from the late 1800s, you had families like the Toot families and these other black prominent families starting to rise. And many of them traveled to the United States to go to school. I think the catalyst of this would, of course, been the great Joseph Robert Love, teacher and mentor to Marcus Garvey and one of the founders of Pan-Africanism. And that was also Bahamian's role in terms of our migration to the United States. And it was this interesting thing, the great work, you know, I love to shout out fellow historians and colleagues, the great scholar Tracy Thompson, you know, she did a lot of recordings and interviews of people that participated in the contract. And I delved deeply into that doing some research recently, and I smiled and saw how it actually connected to my personal research, which is the Bahamians' involvement in the Pan-Africanist movement. I spent too much time on that, but we often like to, when we talk about, particularly in regards to Garvey, they talk about Joshua Cockburn. Of course, he was the man that would have testified against Garvey in the federal case. And probably the beginning of the end, or let me not say the end, but the beginning of the end of the glory days of the UNIA, right? But also you have to consider that the Black Star Liner could not have manifested without the assistance of Joshua Cockburn as well. But straying away from him, you had people on both sides of Garvey, a mentor and Joseph Robert Love, who I mentioned before, but also people like Alexander Ramming and Frederick Toot, who was the son of Thaddeus Toot, and the brother of Thaddeus Toot Jr. And they're the two famous ones. People don't know about the brother Frederick, who was the radical Pan-Africanist one, who ended up going to Philadelphia and founded the UNIA chapter there. And he even served for about a year or two as the president of the UNIA right after Garvey's demise. Right?
Let's talk about Coconut Grove.
So Coconut Grove was essentially founded by Bahamians who were moving up there to do work. You know, even from long time, you know, the Florida Keys, when you go to places like Key West, you're seeing like Russell Street and Higgs Street. And all of these are names that came from the Bahamas, right? And Bahamians literally built South Florida. That's not really an understatement. When you look at areas like Homestead, and even when you look at the construction that was done all around, similar to like the Panama Canal, right? It was a lot of Bahamian hands. And even there are cases and reports of Bahamians, as with the Panama Canal, who would have lost their lives and been in these super harsh working conditions. Now, hopping back up to the 20th century, this migration was largely a result of, you know, the same reason most people migrate. You're looking for a better life. You're looking for a way to feed your family. You understand what I'm saying? You ain't going there to take over nothing, but I can leave that right there. Now, the typical image that you see, and it was really the typical happenings in terms of this thing that we know as the contract, which essentially began around the time of the beginning of World War II. And ended right before majority rule, essentially, right? So this was a long thing. And of course, generally speaking, Bahamians were migrating to the United States.
And when you say Bahamians, you mean black and white Bahamians?
Mostly black, overwhelmingly black, but also some white too. Now, this is can let us lead us into the point where I want you to do most of talking, because we was talking off air and you was teaching me something just now about some of the, let's call it the complexities of race. No,
a part of Bahamian history where bright-skinned Bahamians who wanted to live in white neighborhoods in the United States, because they came from the Bahamas, they were questioned whether they were white. And they had to write back and get authorization from either their priests or the magistrate to write a reference letter to say, yes, I've known these people, family for years, and they are 100% white, because they had everyone coming from the Bahamas as being black.
Right.
And that's part of our history, too.
Of course. And that's, of course, down to the one-drop rule that's used in the United States to this day, that I say the African diaspora have sort of co-opted to a certain degree, where that anybody who is of clear and obvious African descent who claim in blackness and of the culture, you know, they are considered quote-unquote black today, right? But that was a much more complex issue. But generally speaking, though, it was more impoverished black Bahamians. And interestingly, I would get you in no trouble, but back then you did have, and again, that many of these people were not quote-unquote white, but in the context of Bahamian society, they were white.
You're white Bahamian.
Yeah, and many of them were themselves not wealthy either. You know, and when you look at the records, for example, the newspapers of the paupers, right, and the food and the things and the items that were being given out and distributed by, like, Christchurch Cathedral to the paupers, like, half of those people were white. And then the other half would have been mulattoes and blacks and the like, right? But just these contracts, you know, Bahamians made it as far as Maryland. It wasn't just Florida. That's important to remember, too. The farms in Maryland were considered to be among the best ones in the best condition. They had little huts, but generally most of these Bahamians were living in, like, military tents and all of that. And it really speaks volumes to the reality of the conditions in the Bahamas. Because if you had Bahamians ready to go live in tent and work in swampy conditions with mosquitoes, deal with all that racism, which was fully documented in Tracy Thompson's work, deal with all that racism, all the risk of being lynched and all of these different things, just to make some more money, it kind of tells you how bad things were for people of African descent in the Bahamas before majority rule.
I want to talk about majority rule, but I want to mention the word conks and conky Joe. Just to have them into the conversation, where that word conk come from? And is it connected to the word term conky Joe that we use here in the Bahamas?
It certainly is. So it actually just originated as conks, right?
So the first word was conks.
Right. And this was something that was popularized by, particularly in the context of Bahamas, by the loyalists, right? You see William Wiley, for example, being one of the main loyalists that popularized this. And the conk was a racial epithet, but it was not like the N-word. I've heard some comments like that. So, you know, the conks was by, quote unquote, let's say real white people or people who are more phenotypically European.
English.
Right. The English ones who
versus
saw themselves
the native.
Pure. Right. And this term conks was meant to acknowledge, yes, they are white or creamier skin, but it also was meant to insult them. It's almost like using hick or redneck, but to the umpteenth degree. All of the negative stereotypes that would come with an American southerner living in a rural area, right? So they dumb, they ain't that smart. All them is married a cousin. And these were very similar sentiments that were being expressed by the loyalists towards the quote-unquote white Bahamians that they met who were already here.
So it's prejudice amongst the right white race.
Yeah, certainly. And then over time, as those families began to amalgamate, it took probably less than a generation or two for those things to sort of dissipate, right? And then conk became conky Joe, and then it sort of just evolved into this word that does not hold the same connotations that I guess it would have in the 1790s, obviously, right? But at the end of the day, it still holds some of the same meaning and sort of almost political statement, right? Because we would call a fellow who is clearly not white, but light skin and curly hair and looking really close to white, and we'd call him Conky Joe, knowing that he looked like a quote-unquote mulatto, right? Mm. But all of these terms, believe it or not, began as racial epithets, even though some of them came from what was seen at the time a genuine scientific attempt to describe race, right? And of course, this manifested uniquely in the Bahamas and certainly affected relationships between Bahamians and Americans in migration as well.
But how come the white people in Key West are called conks?
Right, so that pretty much came from the same thing, right? From the same sentiments as well. And as we discussed off air, it's embraced, you know? And I don't know many even, quote-unquote, white Bahamians who take any great offense to being called a conky joke, you know what I mean? And again, it doesn't hold the same sting as the N-word, even though in the Bahamas we love to use that word to refer to each other. I personally don't use it, but at the same time, I don't be out here trying to cover people's mouth who use the word either. I understand that sentiment, but me as a Pan-Africanist, I prefer not to use it. And I actually had to train myself for years not to use it, up until about 5 years ago, if I get really mad, all of a sudden one might slip out, you know, but yeah.
Let's talk about civil rights in the United States and how it impacted the Bahamas. Did we have any civil rights leaders come to the Bahamas? Did we help them in any kind of way?
Oh, we most certainly did not. You might cause us to do a third show, because we could do a show just only on this. You had people like the faction he called Reverend Reggie, his real name being Richard Hicks. He was a Bahamian who migrated to Florida. Revolutionary pastor. He was the founder of the Homestead, the Coconut Grove, UNIA chapters, and a close associate of Marcus Garvey. And he actually had to leave the Bahamas because he was beaten to a pulp and left for dead by the Ku Klux Klan, actually.
They're the Ku Klux Klan in the Bahamas?
No, in Florida. Oh, that's okay. When he's in Florida. And then he came back, and then he served as pastor at Metropolitan Baptist Church. All those ones right there in that tin shop, you know, that old gas station on Bluewell Road North, right before you reach, you know, Southern Recreational Ground area. That's where he was. And there's three churches all around there where he actually used to preach. And he was this very revolutionary Pan-Africanist style preacher. You had, of course, James Weldon Johnson and John Rosamond Johnson. Mm-hmm. And these were the composers of what is considered now globally the quote-unquote Black National Anthem.
Lift
every voice and sing. Mm-hmm. And they were the composer and the producer. I don't know the technical terms, but those two brothers did that. They also even did other popular songs that we don't know.
Let's remind the people who they were, or how they connected to the Bahamas.
Oh, so they connected to the Bahamas, of course, through their mother, who was the daughter of Stephen Dillett. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Stephen Dillett, of course, we know was an emigre originally from Haiti, right? And then he married a Bahamian woman, had a daughter who was the mother of James and John Johnson. Right? And they composed that famous song. They were great composers, actually, and they were huge pioneers in American entertainment. But they was almost like Dave Chappelle and them fellas long before them. Mm-hmm. So they were Black celebrities who were actually for the civil rights cause. Mm-hmm. And as we know, even to this day, most Black celebrities kind of doing the opposite, if we being frank.
Moving away from it.
Yeah. And then you had people like Alexander Ramming, who was the founder of the first chapter, Harlem chapter of the UNIA under Marcus Garvey. And that shows you how Bahamians were sort of on both sides of Garvey as his mentor and as his protege as well. Then you had Edwin Pratt. His daddy was Joseph Pratt from Kid Island. They called him the Martin Luther King of Seattle. And he desegregated schools and water fountains. There's a park, a fine arts center, and an early learning center that's named in his honor.
So we had scores of Bahamians who were prominent civil rights leaders in the United States.
I tell you, that's a whole nother show series right there. We could do one on each one of them.
So how does Sidney Poitier become a civil rights leader or impacted us in the Bahamas?
Right. So, of course, a part of civil rights, sometimes there's this old saying That sometimes a lot of people who make history, they don't really be trying to make history, right? So, of course, Sidney Poitier was trying to be an outstanding actor, and he accomplished that. So, in that sense, he made history. But in a lot of cases, like with Sidney Poitier, you know, he might not have openly expressed his Pan-Africanist sentiments. And at that time, you have to be careful in judging, because there's a time when you could get lynched. Mm-hmm. Someone come kidnap you, you go missing, and that's the end of that. But he was close friends with people like James Baldwin. I don't know if a lot of people know that. You know, James Baldwin is one of the most radical people out there.
Pioneer writer.
Activist on many different fronts, as a matter of fact, right? But him becoming the first black man, of course, to win an Academy Award, just in that fact, for best actor, and the value that we as people in our modern history have always placed on entertainers, on film and stuff like that, it certainly spoke volumes. And of course, one of the greatest cinematic moments in my history, and because of what it meant, I believe it was the movie In the Heat of the Night.
Yeah, they banned it in the Bahamas.
Right, they banned it for a period in certain states, in certain areas in the United States. And of course, there's that famous scene. You know, he is this hotshot detective that came in, and he was smarter than everyone, more eloquent than everyone. He did it purposefully to never take these demeaning roles, to sort of uplift and always have a positive portrayal of blacks. All of these things were purposefully done by him. And for me, this is what sort of puts him in that category as civil rights leader. And of course, that scene where the white racist police captain slap him, and it was unscripted, and Sidney Poitier had to turn around and slap him right back on screen, and they kept it in the film. And of course, at the time, that was something that was completely outrageous to many a white American at the time. Right?
But Sidney Poitier also brought people like Harry Belafonte and various other prominent actors here in the Bahamas.
Right forward, yeah, certainly. Yeah, you know, that's another sort of bit of misinformation that you hear about a lot of Bahamians celebrities. It's like a syndrome, and not just with Bahamians. You see it everywhere. And people feel like someone come from somewhere and don't do enough for that. But Sidney Poitier seems to have been someone who was doing a lot, but just sort of did it quietly, you know? Yeah.
Okay. We're going to take a quick commercial break. I can entertain some calls right now. It's almost 11:45, because you know when 11:45 is all Percy Island's game, right? Yeah. Right? So let's take this quick commercial break. We'll be right back.
Just sign in and have a seat, please. They'll call you in for your x-ray shortly.
That's why they call it a waiting room. You won't have that problem at Fourth Terrace Diagnostic Center or Imaging at Groner. We never schedule multiple appointments, so you'll be in and out in no time. And if your initial screening reveals a concern, our radiologists can conduct an alternative screening right then and there. Call 328-8157 to schedule an appointment at Fourth Terrace Diagnostic Center or Imaging at Groner today.
Wait, you know what's going down tomorrow?
Nobody, what happening?
Joe bringing the knife to school? He could do Junior in?
For what?
Wait, he fooled with Joe girl?
Mother sick. And you know Junior don't back down for nothing. So that means you got a big fight tomorrow.
So whose side you want?
Side? I trying to stay in school, not Simpson fan. You gotta tell somebody about this fight.
Tell somebody? I ain't no snitch. I mean cool, you know.
Wait, if you so cool, then you need to stay in school and stay out of the fight.
Yeah, but if I don't hang on Joe's side, him and he boys coming for me next.
All right, so we definitely gotta tell somebody. We gotta prevent the fight.
What I say, I don't want nobody call me snitch.
We could just call Crime Stoppers. You could report what you know, and nobody gotta know it's you.
So how do I avoid?
All you gotta do is call them, or you text them through the Crack Crime Bahamas app, and nobody can know it's you.
Then the police come looking for me for more info, and when they finish with them, Joe them coming looking for me?
When you call Crime Stoppers, the call go directly to Miami, and they don't ask nothing about you. Then you can get the pin from them, and they can claim a reward later using that same pin.
Plus, everything's scrambled, so nobody can read what you're saying.
Calls 328-8477 from Nassau, or 242-300-8477 from the Family Islands.
No budget for a vacation this summer? No worries. We got you. Guardian Radio 96.9 will fly you and a guest to South Florida for a vacation of a lifetime. Our sweet summer escape gets you round-trip tickets on Bahamas Air. $1,000 spending cash, thanks to Percy's Island Games. Brand new luggage from Brass and Leather. 4 days and three nights at the beautiful Holiday Inn Express Plantation. Free car rental from Hertz, too. All you need is your passport. We got you covered. Enter now for the Guardian Radio 96.9 Sweet Summer Escape. Fill out the form in today's Nassau Guardian and follow us on all social media platforms. Remember, You must be 18 or older to enter. Entry deadline August 12th, drawing August 14th. Taxes not included and certain restrictions apply.
Guess who's back?
It's that time again for the 31st annual Michael Scudery Peace on the Streets Basketball Classic.
Bring it on now, let's go.
Whether you're a player or a fan, you don't want to miss this one. The action starts July 13th at the Hope Center. Log on to peaceonthestreets.com and register.
Come on, everybody, we're going.
That's the Peace on the Streets Basketball Classic.
Where we shoot hoops instead of guns.
Game time. Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
We're going to give you a check every week for a year.
Percy Pentagon, Island Game. Keep you winning. Percy Pentagon. Dream big, we will help you live it.
Percy Pentagon Island Game, we got you.
Percy Pentagon,
from the friends you can trust, if winning is a must, go play the game you know, cause your best chance is with us. The most trustworthy name is Percy's Island Game. So put 20 on your account and ride this easy train at
Percy's Island Game.
Headed to South Florida soon? Holiday Inn Express in Plantation welcomes you to the heartbeat of Florida fun. Whether it's business or pleasure, the Holiday Inn Express is close to sensational shopping, captivating dining, and nightlife. Elevate your Florida experience. Sleep well and rest easy at Holiday Inn Express. Complimentary breakfast buffet featuring seasonal favorites. Keep up your fitness routine in our 24-hour on-site fitness center with cardio equipment and free weights, or take a refreshing swim in our outdoor pool. Your special Bahamas tourist rate awaits. Holiday Inn Express, 1701 North University Drive in Plantation. Book your getaway now. Call directly at 954-472-5600 or the sales department for reservations and additional information.
Attention, Island Game players. Attention, Island Game players. Percy's pension plan is now accepting application. You hear me? Percy is now accepting application. Deposit as little as $25, and you are able and officially able to be in the running for a weekly salary up to $1,000 per week for a full year. Imagine that. 52 weeks in a year, and you get $1,000 every week. That's $52,000. Applications close on September 8th. Apply now at theislandgame.com and be able to win that $1,000 a week. Before we leave, Chris, we were talking about now post the early 1900s, we're in the early 20th century. Mm-hmm. We were talking about civil rights leaders in the Bahamas as activists, and we go in there in the United States as activists. We now in a majority rule in the Bahamas,
right?
We're turning an independent country any minute now. Yeah. We're talking about the Hawksbill Creek Agreement. We talk about all of that, but I want to know how that impacted the United States, or how the United States impacted us during that time.
Right. So tourism, of course, was now becoming this huge thing. But as I mentioned, too, you know, a lot of these now blacks who were getting money, and they were coming to get and raising money and sending their people off to school and all that. So you have people like C.R. Walker, S.E. McPherson, these names, A.F. Adderley, all of these were people who went off, many of them to the United States, came back and became our local civil rights leaders, right? And so, of course, the Progressive Liberal Party was founded in 1953 by Bill Cartwright, Cyril Stevenson, and Henry Taylor. Right?
Let me pause you there. Only one of them considered themselves white, eh?
Right, only, right. So, and that's the interesting thing. So you often hear people say, oh, you know, it's white fellas who founded the PLP. But these were fellas who had that sort of international exposure. And at the time, and even now, you see a lot of Bahamians have a sort of, in regards to race, I should say, a sort of fishbowl mentality. You know what I mean? And I think that those men, of course, understood that they were, in fact, not, quote-unquote, white.
I mean, Henry Taylor tell you point blank, I'm a black man. In his speech, I am a black man trying to survive this, that.
Exactly.
I mean, no, Civil Stevenson is darker than him.
Right, you know. And of course, certainly in the United States, they would have been considered black, right?
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, some of them wouldn't have liked them more than me and you, because me and you just dark-skinned black.
Mm-hmm.
But a fella like him shows that when European and African come together, that person is no longer quote-unquote white through their eyes and based on their racial gradation. So race, of course, was always a sort of huge factor. And of course, the Cold War and American politics,
mm-hmm.
as it does to this day and globally, not just the bombers, but particularly for us, we have always been sort of in like a vice grip of fear of certain obligation to act a certain way, to be a certain way.
Mm.
And at this time, globally, you see the independence of Ghana and all these independence movements, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and then it's shifting over to here, where you see places like Trinidad and Tobago becoming a republic out the gate, right? But with our proximity to the United States, with the politics of the Cold War, at the same time, you know, it was the United States that supported people like Papa Doc, right? And this was based on Cold War politics. You know, once he was in socialist, that was the end of that. And even though we would have had people who would have had more socialist leanings, there was a, what was the name of that party?
Vanguard?
Not just Vanguard. It was another one, Unicom.
Okay.
Unicom.
I thought it was like a college group.
Yeah, and the CIA was here watching the happenings leading up to majority rule. And of course, there were many uprisings as well. You know, they had the Burma Road uprising.
But wait, let me pause you. So we had a presence of socialist, communist people in the Bahamas at one point in time?
Yes, we did. Trevor Monroe, that was the name of the guy. He was actually from Guyana. And he was a predecessor to the more famous Walter Rodney.
Mm.
And so coming out of Guyana, do you see, you can look at their flag and see what they was dealing with. You get where they coming from? They get the red, gold, and green. They get the Pan-Africanist colors in their flags. And they were trying to spread these sentiments throughout the Caribbean. And those other nations that had gotten that before, but this was something that was highly political. And the CIA was even here throughout the late 1960s and did a report saying that, man, this socialist party, they look like they only have about 1,000 supporters and there's no danger of them. And essentially what they were saying in diplomatic terms that these Negroes and the bombers are good Negroes.
They're good Negroes.
Right? And this is sort of this line that we always had to toe. And it's not casting any blame on anybody. You know, when you look at our geographic location, the political climate in the world at the time and today, we have Haiti at the south, who, being sarcastic, of course, made the mistake of daring to free themselves from their oppression and slavery and paying for it to this day. You have Cuba, which had a socialist revolution, which, of course, was inextricably linked to class and race, which are inextricably linked. And we see the results of the sorts of embargoes and sanctions that have been placed on Cuba. And then we have the United States to the north, where blacks are the minority. They're still getting lynched in the 1960s, civil rights movement and all of that. And, of course, that had a great impact on the Bahamas. People like Adam Clayton Powell, of course, frequented the Bahamas.
We got to explain who Adam Clayton Powell is. Yeah. Congressman,
He was a congressman. And it's so funny because there's so much controversy surrounding his race. Some people say he had a couple drops of black blood in him.
Yeah.
Some people say he was right. Yeah, but in reality, he was just a very, very, very light-skinned, close to white fella who, to be fair, did at times exude that, you know, and that's why many blacks didn't really see him. When you look at people like Kwame Ture, a.k.a. Stokely Carmichael, Malcolm X, they really didn't like him, you know, because they felt that he was too tame and conservative in his approach. My view is, you know, this was a battle, and in hindsight, as historians, we can say this was a battle being fought on many fronts, right? And everyone ain't a warrior too. So you can't expect everyone to go there in one fight.
I wanted to mention that Clayton Powell lived in the Bahamas for a period of time.
Bimini, I believe. That was where he really fell in love with. And of course, Bimini is where they say Martin Luther King wrote his I Have a Dream speech, which became his most iconic speech, right? And then even Marcus Garvey, of course, visited the Bahamas as well. The Bahamas was right there in the Pan-African Dominican sentiment in the Bahamas was pretty strong. And there were even people like, I'm trying to throw too much shade because I know on Guardian, but there were even like the Depute family.
Okay.
This was a good example of what they would call the, you already have the saying, like they'll be like, oh, you sound light-skinned or, mm-hmm. you know, in America. Well, some people would call it the mulatto complex, and mm-hmm. that certainly was strong as well. And you had people like Etienne Depute, who on one side would claim that he wants to see greater voting rights for Black Bahamians, but on the other side, he would be ridiculing the Pan-Africanist movement and treating Marcus Garvey as like some type of crazy kook. Mm-hmm. You understand what I'm saying? But in hindsight, we know Marcus Garvey seems to be the man mm-hmm. with the blueprint, right? And you got dozens of nations throughout the world that, right? But this was, the Bahamas was certainly mixed into all of this, right? Our move to majority rule and independence is, in fact, a part of this global African diaspora march towards more autonomy, towards independence. Though, of course, England is still our head of state, right?
I want to add and question mm-hmm. you about Randall Fox, because his yeah. education seemed to be more American-oriented.
Right, yeah.
And civil rights from that instead of an African pan.
Certainly.
African,
and he did have more socialist leanings, as did people like Arthur Hanoh. And the others, you know, and, you know, I got to, you know, me, I a Pan-Africanist before everything, and also an historian. And to be honest, the fact that people like, you know, and I love the man, love the family. His daughter taught me music for years. I remember in music class, she was teaching us the song Lift Every Voice and Sing, mm-hmm. though I couldn't appreciate it at the immature age of 16 years mm-hmm. old. I was into other things, you know. But at the same time, Lyndon Pinden, you could put all them on this list, you know. All of these fellas, and sort of diminished the movement. And I feel that that is one of the reasons why Bahamians don't view this as a Pan-Africanist struggle, as a racial struggle, as being as profound. You even hear people saying, though I agree with the sentiment, the king is still the head of state, and that diminishes our sense of independence. There's still, even if you want to celebrate it, at least do it in a form of remembrance, mm-hmm. because there were people that lost their lives. There were sacrifices that were made in order for us to become as independent as we are.
Let's take this call right. and talk about independence for the Bahamas and right. what does independence mean for a Black majority and, of course, a white minority and, right. of course, the in-between where we just can't say what it is, right?
Right.
Every other color. Right. Go ahead, caller. Guiding Radio AM, you live.
Good morning, Mr. Nuri. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How you doing?
Yeah, and I'm to your guest. It's so nice to hear him again.
Yes, sir.
He mentioned Sir Eddie and Earl a while ago. Mr. Nuri, if you give me a minute mm-hmm. here. You remember we were talking about Ida Depute and Leon Depute, who started the Tribune.
I remember right. you telling me it 12 times.
Yeah,
I know. But when he mentioned the last time, he mentioned that Ida Depute married a man named Sam Mims.
Yes, but you
now,
mentioned
Sam Mims
12
was my
times
grandfather.
But Sparky.
Yes.
You got to shorten it. I remember you talking about it, but you remember...
Yeah,
you,
I'm trying to get him. I'm trying to get him to explain to me. Sam Mims, I think, caused a broker between Ida Depute and Leon Depute, because Sam, I think, was a Black man from Exuma, and he married yeah. Leon Depute's sister, who them two started the Tribune, and then he disassociated himself from his sister, who was my grandmother, Ida Depute. She married right. Sam Mims.
So that Sam Mims would have been a later Sam Mims than the one who became the first known Black ordained Anglican preacher.
Mm.
So that one, he would, but I think if my memory serves me correctly, he was born in 1809. But when you look at that whole family tree, you see that many names are being repeated. So I'm sure that same Samuel Mims right there would have been the grandson of him. So when I mention Samuel Mims, I'm talking about the son of Rosette Mims, or the woman from the Congo, mm-hmm. the African woman, who was formerly enslaved in the Bahamas, and John Mims, who was the indentured baker from England, who Rosette Mims saved
I think
his
that's
life.
Abaco, and then one became his son became a politician or something
right.
like that.
Thomas Mims was his other son, who was with Stephen Dillett, actually, and became one of three of the first Black men elected to Parliament in 1832. Mm-hmm. And then it was four of them, actually. John Boyd, I think, was the other one.
That's the poet, the German right. who wrote the first Black poetry
right,
book.
Something. And then the white Bahamians came around, was like, oh, and they pretty much started to take the votes back, and there was a little mini riot right there on George Street, and they beat up the guy who was the attorney general at the time, I believe. Who was it? Oh, name escaped me. Just hopped right out of my head. It wasn't Charles Nesbitt. I can't remember. It was McQueen. Yeah.
Let's talk about independence and what independence means for both countries, United States and the Bahamas, and how we should be looking at it as people.
Of course, it's very different. From the African perspective, you asked about that one. It's very different. Of course, the United States continued chattel slavery for a little more than 80 years after they declared independence, right? But in our context, slavery was long gone when that happened. And of course, blacks are the majority, and we, in fact, are the descendant of the victims of chattel slavery. So in that context, of course, it's very different. One thing you see Americans do, whether it's on the conservative, particularly on the conservative side, even though much of it is erroneous and taken out of context, but they all believe in this sort of story, highly romanticized story in the founding of their nation. And I don't know if those sentiments exist here. Might actually be because of the difference in demographics, us being descended of people who were, for the most part, forcibly brought here. Even if you descended only from displaced or liberated Africans, they still were forced to come on this side of the world from slave ships, right? But of course, even if you hold these Pan-African sentiments, as I do, it does not completely prevent me from celebrating, or I should say remembering, Bahamian independence. And I think a part of the problem, as we've adopted some of the sentiments of the United States as well, and we view independence as sort of this one singular event standing on its own, when many of the things that we've been talking about, these acts of resistance, even uprisings, Golden Grove, from the plantation days leading up to now, the people that lost their lives in the Burma Road Uprising, Roy McIntosh and John Johnson and some others, people that led it, like the fella named, who they called Potato, and then the other one named Leonard Storr, you know. These people who made sacrifices for us to get where we are now. So, of course, I would agree with the sentiment that we are not fully independent, whether it's from the fact that Chucky Boy over there is still our head of state, or the fact that we are still at the mercy of Western and American imperialism, right? Both those factors are strong arguments to say, well, we ain't independent, but we are to a degree. If tomorrow we want to pass a law that says this and that, you know, you see, for example, African nations are still in the Commonwealth. Some of them might even still have that head of state thing, but they passing their own laws, regardless of that imperial
question. Questions. We have a lot of critics said white Bahamians celebrate independence differently from black Bahamians. Why?
Well, it's because it's a different history, right? We would be tend more to embrace that history. Well, quote unquote, white Bahamians would not. But my saying to that would be for us, most of y'all to just come home. You know what I mean? And as you see that there are many white Americans that celebrates Nat Turner's Rebellion and the Civil Rights Movement and revere Martin Luther King, they should just put their feelings on the side because it's history and embrace it. And if we are a democracy, they need to side with the majority, which is the African people, and actually embrace Dick DeVoe's Rebellion, Pompey's Revolt, instead of trying to sweep everything under the proverbial rug.
Yeah. I'll end with that. This ends our series on independence as we march towards independence. Of course, we were comparing and contrasting American independence to the Bahamian independence and how we impacted the U.S. Country in general, and how the United States, of course, impacted the Bahamas in general. And it was a celebration. It was a celebration of both nations as we move towards independence. This has been Guardian Radio AM with C.A. Nuri. You have a wonderful day.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM, streaming on GuardianTalkRadio.com and the Guardian Radio app, Nassau, Bahamas.